Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. One of my fascinations, of course, is that whole process by which the right lost its mind, and the rise and the enabling by much of the conservative movement of not just the alt-right, but just this culture of grifters and bigots. And I had a piece up at the Bulwark yesterday, you know, talking about the fact that the president continues to normalize much of this behavior. The Facebook finally gets around to banning a group of conspiracy theorists, crackpots, and racists. And the president of the United States decides that he is going to champion them, that he's going to throw the cloak of his prestige over them, portraying them as victims. We're talking about Alex Jones and Paul Neal and people like Paul Joseph Watson, people who are, you know, up until 5 minutes ago, conservatives would have denied that they were actually conservatives because they are some of them are the worst of the worst of the fever swamp. But this has been part of the process that's been happening in the conservative movement, that people who had been on the fringes, the sorts of mouth breathers that William F. Buckley Jr. would have expelled back in the 1960s, somehow they've made their way back in. They've been normalized. And so you're even seeing people like Tucker Carlson saying, well, who is standing up for us? And I asked the question in the piece, so when did, you know, we become Paul Neelan? When did Laura Loomer become us? What does that mean? And at the end of the piece, I say that this is another reason why you have to go out and read this extraordinary piece about a young woman who had gotten enmeshed in the alt-right and then became part of this pipeline that takes her to the Daily Caller and Breitbart and Charles Johnson and WorldNet Daily. And it becomes enmeshed in this conservative, racist tweeting in order to own the libs. And this piece really does describe part of this phenomenon. And and I quote from it. Her story is about support systems and pipelines. It's about how an angry conservative with reactionary views got herself involved with a small coterie of ideologues in Washington and prepped for a conservative media career in the crucial years before the rise of Donald Trump, as extremism became more popular on the right and as people could optimize themselves for success through attention on social media. And she points out that the legacy of this era, even though the alt-right is clearly in some decline, at least for the moment, the racism, the spread of white nationalist ideas online, and the murder in Charlottesville, Virginia, will affect American politics for a long time to come. It's an extraordinary story, and it raises so many questions, and there are so many familiar characters. And so we are lucky enough to have on the podcast the author of that piece, Rosie Gray from BuzzFeed. Rosie, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you tell the story of your long-running relationship now with this young woman named Katie McHugh, who the subhead describes as once notorious for her racist and bigoted tweets. Katie McHugh saw the dark insides of the white nationalist movement. And she apparently wants to say, hey, I'm sorry about that. I now see that I was wrong. So tell me about how you got to know her in the first place. How somebody from BuzzFeed gets to know one of the trolls from the darkest corners of the fever swamp and, you know, one of the most notorious hit people from Breitbart.
Well, when I first heard from her through a friend of hers who reached out to me, it was while I was actually still at The Atlantic last summer, but I was about to leave to work on a book that I'm working on. So I heard from her, I began talking to her, and, you know, over time she agreed to sort of go on the record to do this, to be my subject for this piece. So, you know, I would say, you know, long running relationship is stretching it a little bit. You know, I've known her for maybe, you know, since last August or so. But, you know, it was kind of a process of gradually sort of building trust. And, you know, as I described in the piece, she had sort of written this first person essay about her experiences, which was the first indication, and that was shown to me by her friend. And that was the first indication to me that she had, that she wanted to basically like tell her story. And, you know, I had kind of forgotten about her after she got fired from Breitbart in 2017, like I think a lot of people had.
Now, well, she's 28 years old, right?
She is.
Okay. We will come back to that. And I want to make it clear that when you're talking about somebody being, you know, alt-right, she makes no bones about the fact that she was a white nationalist. She hung around with Holocaust deniers. She would have dinners with people like David Irving, the notorious Holocaust denier. She had relationships with people who are overt racists. So this is not something. We're not just talking about somebody who is described by a social justice warrior as a racist. She was full on into it, and she acknowledges that.
She does acknowledge that. Yeah, she admits that she was a racist, that she was a white nationalist. She's not pretending that that was not the case.
It's an interesting culture you describe, because she's out there tweeting these things that are angry, they're bitter, they attack Muslims. And there's not only no stigma to it, it really became kind of a rite of initiation, right, for much of that conservative media, you know, that you can show that you are not just edgy, but that if somebody accuses you of being racist, you just laugh at them, because that's sort of the thing. If you trigger somebody, somehow you have scored. So again, you point out her tweets were not just edgy; they were racist and anti-Muslim, and yet she was able to parlay that into a relatively successful career for a while at publications that were extremely influential on the right, like Breitbart.
Right. I mean, you know, I think that one of the, you know, big things that I got into with this piece was the fact that she was kind of getting away with this stuff really sort of in plain sight. I mean, there wasn't, you know, she was hiding a lot of her activities from her employers at Breitbart, like, you know, having dinner with David Irving, for example, that kind of thing. She wasn't telling them about that sort of stuff that she was sort of doing behind the scenes. But I mean, like, just her tweets alone, I think were a pretty clear indication of what her politics and views were. And yet, you know, she was, she worked there for years, and, you know, didn't get fired until 2017, which was after Steve Bannon had left, obviously, which changed the dynamics of Breitbart.
We're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, but I want to get back to all of that. So she's a young college student, and the way you describe it, or the way she describes her her conversion to the hard right, the gateway drug was reading Joe Sobran. And his hard turn toward sort of, you know, post-constitutional conservatism, correct? Joe Sobran, a lot of conservatives probably still remember him. He was so extreme that he was fired by National Review. He was at one point excommunicated, but apparently remained influential.
Well, right. I mean, she talks about how she discovered his writing through somebody that she knew at church, became a big fan, began reading a lot of Sobran, and that was actually how she got introduced to even farther right material like Vider or Amren.
Amren being American Renaissance, which is straight up white nationalist.
Right. And by, you know, Googling Joe Sobran obituaries when he died, and that's how she sort of says that she stumbled upon sites like that. So it was sort of through her reading of Sobran that it kind of opened the door to sort of fringier ideologies for her.
Okay, so she gets into this pipeline, organizations like the Institute for Humane Studies, Intercollegiate Studies Institute, which is a group that I've worked with in the past. They get her internships at the Daily Caller. She ends up at Breitbart. As you point out, there's really no secret about how out there she is. And you tell a number of stories that indicate that they knew, including Steve Bannon, that he knew what was going on. One editor, there are very few sort of heroes in your story, but one is an editor named Brandon Darby, who at one point sounds like he tried to blow the whistle on her for tweeting neo-Nazi websites, right? I mean, he called her out, he copied Bannon on it. What happened?
Right. Well, this is the email thread that you're referring to. It was Brandon Darby emailing Bannon and a couple of the other sort of top officials at Breitbart, and pointing out to them that Katie McHugh had been retweeting this, you know, very this like very racist and bad alt-right account, and you know, he was bringing this to their attention. He copied Katie on the thread and he said point blank to her, "I think you're a white supremacist. Like, what do you have to say?" Despite this, you know, pretty significant sort of like red flag or warning that was raised to them, I mean, she still worked there for a couple years after that.
She will continue to work there. Another story, she brings this, I couldn't find his first name here, a relatively well-known white nationalist again. Again, these people who, this is not like a slur, they would identify themselves this way. A guy named, was it Saucier?
Yeah, Devin
Saucier. Yeah, yeah. And she brings him along to a party where he meets Bannon. And Bannon knows who he is and knows what his affiliations are, correct?
Well, the way that she tells the story is that she brought Saucier to Breitbart's CPAC party in 2015. And basically that she introduced him to Bannon, and Bannon was sort of guessing where he worked at and finally guessed AMREN, American Renaissance, and this guy, Saucier, who has edited under a pseudonym at that website, you know, sort of responded affirmatively. And Bannon, per Katie's recollection, said, "We're all fighting the same fight."
Yeah, we were all fighting the same fight, which will sound familiar. As long as we're triggering the libs or doing something, you know, we're not gonna call you out. She was also got some publicity back in 2016, and I remember this when Lloyd Grove for the Daily Beast wrote about how there were, you know, how Bannon was using some of his young staffers at Breitbart to attack his enemies, people including Rick Wilson. And when he asked a comment about all of this, one of the editors wrote back that, we're considering actually making her a weekly columnist. So again, she was encouraged. She was one of their stars, despite them knowing pretty much where she was coming from.
You know, I think that's an interesting point, because I do think that, you know, she says she does believe, and she's quoted in the piece as saying that she believes that she was on some level, you know, encouraged to always sort of be edgier, you know, do sort of like more attention getting stuff. And that she kind of like took that as, you know, carte blanche to like keep behaving this way. I do think, though, that she over time, she began sort of recognizing more like her own personal responsibility in this. Like at the end of the day, the person whose fault it is that she said those things is her.
Yeah. You talked to Richard Spencer for this piece about her. Richard Spencer, who may be the notorious, one of the best known of the white supremacists out there. What did he say about her?
He was a little bit dismissive. He said, "Oh, you know, she was just a hater. Like she was never, you know, somebody
being
who
called
was particularly
a hater by Richard Spencer."
You know, he said she was never somebody who was particularly ideological. You know, he said that he had met her on several occasions. He also said something that I thought was sort of interesting, which is that that there was this attempt to get, quote unquote, our guys sort of into the system, and that he viewed it as a failure because it resulted in, you know, just people with white nationalist sympathies, which in his mind is good, just sitting in the conservative movement, doing nothing, as he put it, accomplishing nothing. And so, you know, from his perspective, this sort of like infiltration of conservative institutions by white nationalists was a failure that didn't result in the kind of goals that he wants to achieve. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was sort of like an interesting point, considering what the story is about, which is like the ability of these people to really sort of operate under the radar in the conservative movement, basically.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that he said that she didn't really have any conventional political beliefs, but extreme emotion. It was really all about the posture. Okay, so let's fast forward. She was doing all these tweets, hanging out with white nationalists. She's at Breitbart. She was a quasi-star at Breitbart. At one point you described they treated her like a queen, which, I mean, you could imagine the culture there. She's 24 years old. And she finally has a tweet in 2017 that gets her fired. Now, this must have come as a surprise to her, because the tweet that got her – what was the tweet that got her fired?
She was tweeting about Muslims in the UK, and she tweeted there would be no deadly terror attacks in the UK if Muslims didn't live there.
Okay, does not seem any more extreme than any of the other of dozens of tweets that are out there, and yet she's fired for it. She had to have been taken by surprise by that, because she figured, this is what I do. This everything else has been edgy. I've been applauded for it. Why did she get fired for that one?
I mean, the dynamic at Breitbart by that time had changed considerably from the way it was you know, when Steve Bannon was still in charge of it. There had been a cultural shift away from the sort of like anything goes, you know, vibe that he had. You know, Breitbart was also sort of in an interesting period of trying of almost being like much more mainstream than it once been, because it had this like such a close sort of like alliance with the Trump movement and the Trump White House. You know, they had tried to like hire more mainstream reporters. They tried to get like congressional press passes. And I think that, you know, Katie had finally, it had just become the last straw. Like Katie was, and her sort of alt-right sympathies, it was finally sort of too much.
Okay, so then her career goes from there to working for Charles Johnson. And if there's a really the darkest corner of the fever swamp for people who aren't familiar with him, longtime internet troll who somehow descended from, you know, being a really awful troll to being a really awful Holocaust denier. She ends up working for him for a while, and that doesn't work out.
Right. That was a sort of a short-lived situation in which she was basically contracting for his Got News website until, you know, she got fired in June of 2017, and she worked for Johnson until October of that year. And, you know, she was basically, you know, writing and editing. And that was actually sort of the time period when, you know, the first cracks really started to appear in her relationship with the alt-right, because she wrote a story that was, you know, very critical of what happened in Charlottesville. Mm-hmm. Though she acknowledges that at the time she was still a white nationalist.
So tell me about the Daily Caller and how they fit into this, because there's a little sub story about an email exchange that one of the editors of Daily Caller had with her after she'd already been fired from Breitbart, offering to help her. And that email exchange has gotten him fired. So what's the story there?
Yeah, you're referring to Dave Brooks, mm-hmm. who until recently was an editor at the Daily Caller News Foundation. And the email exchange that you're talking about was, you know, after she had gotten fired, he emailed her and said, what happened, you know, and she told him what happened. And then he basically responded in a way that showed that he like had a lot of familiarity with some of these alt-right people, such as American Renaissance, you know, Jared Taylor, Devin Sociay, and basically offered to like help her try to find work in that sphere. So when I asked the Daily Caller about this email exchange while I was reporting this story, they got back to me. Neil Patel got back to me and told me that they had fired David Brooks because of it.
And they had apparently no idea that he was that deep in the, that he was swimming with the alt-right folks before that?
You know, I don't know. I don't know whether it's necessarily fair to say that he was totally swimming with the alt-right folks. I don't have it in front of me, but, you know, he indicated to me in his statement about this that he was just sort of trying to help her. He had some far-right contacts and thought that would be, you know, good for her. I don't want to get too deep right on the Dave Brooks thing, because I don't want to, you know, that's, but it is true that, you know, this email exchange, he used the word cock in this email exchange, like showed that he sort of knew about like certain job openings in that sphere.
Okay, before we get, I want to talk about the larger picture here and what this says about the conservative media. Tell us about the Wolves of Vinland. This is sort of the strange, you know, just when I think I can't be surprised anymore. So not only does she hang around with these folks sort of socially and, you know, works for some of these websites, but her boyfriend is this rather extreme white nationalist who hangs with the Wolves of Vinland. What the hell?
So her ex-boyfriend, Kevin Deanna, who was the founder of Youth for Western Civilization, which was this sort of, you know, supposedly pro-Western values, pro-the-West group, which has been kind of like a meeting point for some of these people. He was involved with this group called Wolves in Vinland, which is essentially a neo-pagan group that would have these meetups outside of Lynchburg, Virginia. And it was based on this sort of like paganish ideology and theology, and they would have these like meetup things called moots, in which they would give these speeches and like smear ash on their bodies around a fire and stuff.
So they play it Viking or something. It's like, so
it is definitely very strange. And it's actually, you know, and it's one of the things that, that in, you know, in Katie's telling was difficult for her to incorporate sort of more fully into her own life. She's a Catholic. She at one point was sort of tempted by paganism, and you know, a friend actually like helped pull her back from that, but it's definitely a strange part of the story. And there is a sort of like anti-Christian thread in white nationalist thinking in some corners of the alt-right, thinking that you know, it's this sort of subversive theology, and that really like white people should be involved in like, you know, pre-Christian Northern European culture.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, who wouldn't want to sacrifice a couple of goats to own the libs? But I mean, that one where they would get together and smear ash on themselves and have, you know, feats of strength where they would lift the back ends of cars and stuff like that. It's it is almost a caricature. OK, so at the end of your story, you know, you're talking about how she now wants to have a path back. She recognizes that this is wrong, that she's taking personal responsibility. And you have this paragraph, which I think is the key. At age 28, she has made herself unemployable in the career field she chose, even on its fringes. She perpetually struggles to support herself financially. It's easy to see how someone in McHugh's position might regret the path she took that got her here. Would she regret it if she still had friends, still had a writing job? And this, I guess, is the question. You know, she's 28 years old. Much of the things that she did took place when she was an adult, and she made all these choices. She said that she's responsible for it. But now she says she's past all that. But she's past all that because she's out of the pipeline. She has no job. She has no friends. So, how, you know, what is your answer to that question? What is, you know her, you've talked to her, you posed it.
Right. I don't know if I really know the answer to that question. I think that, would she feel as regretful about all this if her life had sort of stayed on, you know, an employed, you know, having a vibrant social scene sort of track? I really don't know the answer to that.
Because she never at any point quit any of these jobs, it sounds like. She never actually stood up and said, with the exception of the article that she wrote when she was working for Johnson that you mentioned, she never said, you know, I'm out. This is wrong. I don't want to be part of this. She ends up getting, you know, thrown out. So,
well, one thing that I tried to be very conscious of when I was writing this piece was not taking away her agency.
Right.
And being very clear about the fact that, you know, she ultimately, you're right, like she did this stuff when she was an adult. And at the end of the day, the buck stops with her. No one forced her to be a racist. No one forced her to be a white nationalist. I mean, a lot of this was choices that she made. But the question of how sincerely has she changed? How sincerely regretful does she feel? You know, I think that she's on kind of a journey on this stuff. I do think that she feels sincere regret about what happened and what she did. I don't know the answer to the question of, would she have had this change of heart if, you know, the path that she was on had continued unimpeded?
No,
I don't know that.
You know, and again, when you're caught up in this, when this is your social world, when this is your professional world, when you are in the pipeline, when this is the grift, it is hard to step away from that, particularly when you're in your 20s and it's all exciting and there's all that adrenaline and all of the things going on. So I'm going to kind of look at this bigger picture here. And I want to go back to the beginning where you say that, you know, the reading Joe Sobran, it kind of radicalized her. And she was also an admirer of Ron Paul at one point. In the normal trajectory in the conservative movement, as it once existed in my mythological fantasies and imagination, there would have been somebody along the way, some adult who would have said, Katie, you know, hey, you really don't want to go with this guy. You know, understand, you know, what he represents. There's a reason why he was thrown out of National Review. Hey, why don't you read this book by a, you know, non-racist, non-anti-Semitic conservative? And yet, you know, as part of this breakdown of the gatekeepers, there's also, it sounds like there's just a breakdown of the people that she might have, you know, might have led her into a more constructive way of being engaged. Do you follow me?
Right. I mean, I would refer to the concept that Jane Costin at Vox, who does a great job covering issues on the right, that she talks about a lot, which is this concept of guardrails, and that in the conservative movement, there's often a lack of these sort of guardrails that keep people from veering off in sort of wild directions. You know, there was never really like a mentor who stepped in and said to Katie, you can't do this. And, you know, you need to figure out like what exactly it is that you're doing and like slow down a little bit and change your ways. You know, there wasn't that much like oversight over her and what she was doing. And so, that makes these institutions, these media institutions in particular, like sort of very weak to, and easily sort of penetrated by these sorts of ideologies, because there's the barrier for getting this kind of stuff in there isn't very high.
Well, and also, you know, part of the culture is that you cultivate a sense that you're edgy and you are not able to be shocked. And so there wasn't much of an immune system to all of that. But I mean, I have to admit that, I mean, I knew there were people out there who were like this. And it was only after they'd sort of burst into prominence that I'm looking around going, has this been going on for some time? I mean, you know, young people who embrace ideologies that I thought had been gone for 40 or 50 years here, you know, that in a lot of ways, this was so much worse than I expected. And I think a lot of other conservatives. As you make it very clear in this piece, this is a movement, this is a phenomenon that was growing before Donald Trump came along. He did not create it. But what effect did he have on it?
You know, I think white nationalists felt very energized and felt very encouraged by the Trump campaign. You know, he did disavow them at certain points, but I think that there's no question that they felt that on some level that they were dealing with a fellow traveler. And I think that they, felt that finally the time was sort of coming for white identity politics.
He sort of validated them, right? I mean, he kind of brought them into the mainstream.
Well, I mean, look at what he said about Charlottesville mm-hmm. in 2017, you know, some very fine people on both sides. You know, white nationalist leaders took that as a very encouraging moment. So, like I say in the piece, like the alt-right as a sort of coherent movement is almost kind of over at this point. There's been tons of infighting. Like they never were able to really go mainstream as, you know, as a thing of their own. But I do think that they've been very influential in discourse on the right. And I think part of that is the fact that they were able to sort of like attach themselves to the Trump phenomenon in a way.
No, and I think that's exactly the way to look at it, that they really it's become kind of in the bloodstream, the way in which they communicate, what they have done to the level of our discourse, how they have inverted the standards of what is acceptable, all of those things. But also, and this is beyond the scope of your piece, and it went back to, you know, the Daily Caller and the number of folks who have written for that publication that sort of, you know, passed through this movement. And then you start to see people like Tucker Carlson, who is on the air, and suddenly he's starting to embrace these nationalist ideas and begins to expound them to a much bigger audience. And I remember when this first had people looking around going, this is not the Tucker Carlson we remember. He used to be kind of a libertarian, mainstream conservative. Where is this coming from? So again, you wonder about whether it's moved the window of acceptable conversation somewhat.
I think that, you know, the concept of the Overton window shifting a bit is real. I also think that, you know, there's this ethos on the right of owning the libs, sort of like winning at all costs, that, you know, the Trump movement, the Trump phenomenon definitely has boosted a lot. And I think that that plays into it. And certainly in the case of people like Katie McHugh, had a very damaging and negative effect, because it was just sort of like anger and self-righteousness, and not really like actually making an argument, not really slowing down to have a conversation or to really think, but, you know, no enemies to the right, like just
right.
sort of going for it in that way. And I think that that is something that has become a huge animating factor on the right. And, you know, I think that, that's changed right-wing politics a lot.
Well, and also, you know, even though the alt-right may be in decline, I don't think that part of the phenomenon is over. Over the weekend, the president spent quite some time tweeting about conspiracy theorists and white nationalists and deciding that he's going to side with them after Facebook kicked them off. And again, this is part of the normalization or the mainstreaming, the sense that, you know, we are all part of this together, you know, that, you know, I quoted Tucker Carlson a little bit earlier, you know, saying who's standing up for us? Well, us, you know, I've never thought of Paul Neelan as being any part of us. So that, again, you do see this no enemies on the right culture. And that's going to take us right through 2020.
Right. I mean, I think that, you know, what we're seeing on the right today, I mean, like the conservative movement as a movement is, you've talked about this a lot, it's a pale shadow of its former self. What it's been kind of replaced by is sort of Trumpist politics that are about sort of culture war and winning.
You know, as I'm thinking about this, even though I sort of, you know, passed off the neo-pagan stuff as kind of a humorous sideline, that's actually more important than I think. I wanted to stop there for a second because it is this sort of emphasis of this masculine ubermensch winning at all costs mentality that really has become part of the conservative movement. You know, that even though you have a lot of people who, you know, continue to describe themselves as Christians, the morality is more Nietzschean, isn't it? It is the powerful Superman that does what it takes to win, and it is a test of your masculinity whether or not you support it. And this obsession on the part of some of the Trumpist right that if you are not part of the Trumpist right, this is a sign that you are a cuck. This is a sign that you are low testosterone. This is a sign that you are just simply not manly and courageous enough, you know, to go into the you know, fights at the end of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've definitely identified, you know, a real theme in right wing discourse these days, like surrounding masculinity, you know, particularly as it relates to President Trump, with this focus on sort of being strong, being masculine, the way that, you know, remember how Trump used to call Jeb Bush low energy, mm-hmm. right? Like there's like this issue of strength and masculinity is definitely a big theme. And yeah, I mean, I don't know exactly like how all of this has happened, but it's certainly an animating force.
No, I don't know how it's happened, except that it is sort of the, you know, it's a little bit cult, you know, fraternity, grift, all thrown together with this sort of pseudo intellectual veneer. And you make the point about how a lot of the alt-righters, the alt-right folks had intellectual and cultural pretensions, didn't they? They really wanted to feel like these were not redneck rabbles. These were the sophisticated, they were not only courageous in the pagan sense, but they were also very, very intellectually sophisticated, which of course was bullshit, but it was very important for their self-image, wasn't it?
Well, that's always been sort of Richard Spencer's strategy, right? Is to present himself as kind of like the dapper, non-threatening white nationalist who, you know, reads philosophy and is very cultured. So that's, you know, that's part of his effort and other alt-right people's effort to kind of rebrand white nationalism as something that's, you know, a little bit cooler and more sophisticated.
So what happens to her now? What happens to Katie McHugh?
Well, I don't know. I think you would need to talk to her about it. She's no longer working in media, obviously. And she's moved somewhere else that I can't tell you, but I don't think that as of right now she has any current plans to sort of like try to relaunch her career in media.
Have you talked to her since the article came out?
I did speak with her recently.
Is she okay? I mean, did she? What was her reaction?
I think she felt emotional about the article coming out. Which is, I think, understandable.
Well, what about the reaction of the other people who make their cameo appearances? The, you know, Institute for Humane Studies, the folks from the Daily Caller, the folks from Breitbart, those other publications that for the most part do not come off in a very flattering, or not portrayed in a very flattering way. Not because you portray them in a flattering way, but because of their actual record in hiring, nurturing, praising, and ignoring her behavior.
Well, anybody who was, you know, mentioned in the piece as being a part of this story was obviously reached out to as part of reporting, and I included any responses that I got. So if you look at the piece, you can see how, you know, Breitbart responded, for example, or the Daily Caller, et cetera. There hasn't been a huge amount of, like, trolling by alt-right people on Twitter or anything like that.
Yeah, that's what I was noticing, because there usually is on something like this. But, you know, so, you know, one of the problems I think about, and you do capture this culture, one of the problems of fixing this, of, you know, of trying to imagine folks at various publications, you know, closing the door and saying, hey, we really got to, you know, up our game. We need to, you know, clean up our act, or whatever cliche they want to use. Is this also this cultivation of a sense of shamelessness, that we are never ashamed, we never apologize, which I think, along with the, you know, obsession with triggering the libs and no enemies to the right, really has created part of this culture, is that you just simply, you know, can never acknowledge, and this is what makes this sort of unusual, you know, her piece that she's basically ashamed, is, you know, as I said about Donald Trump, that his shamelessness is his superpower, and he's communicated that to a lot of these organizations in these publications.
Sure. I mean, you know, I think one of the sort of insights that the Trump campaign had during 2016 was that if they didn't apologize for anything, it would still work, you know? And I think that I'm not necessarily the best analyst out there about this, but I do think that one thing that kind of worked to Katie's advantage when she was sort of operating not even very incognito as a white nationalist during her time in Washington was that there wasn't necessarily a willingness to apologize on the part of the people that she was working for, and so she didn't feel like she needed to apologize for
things. I'm just paging here through looking for a quote that you got from one guy, Scott Greer, who she outed. He had been he was a Daily Caller writer who had been writing under a pseudonym, these racist screeds. And he's out. But he basically wrote back that he wasn't apologizing for anything that he, I'm just looking for the quote, I'm unable to find it at the moment, but he's one of those who going, no, I sincerely held these beliefs right now, and so I'm really not apologizing. And so he's still out there. He's still got a career, despite being exposed as somebody writing overtly racist stuff under a pseudonym.
I mean, I don't know how much of a career Scott Greer really has at this point. You know, when I wrote the story about how he had been writing under a pseudonym for Radix Journal, which was Richard Spencer's website, you know, he said that he was going to be severing all ties with the Daily Caller, for which he was then contributing for, and he'd previously before that been a full-time editor at, although when I did that story, he was just a contributor. But so I don't know. I mean, like I haven't really seen much that I like much work coming from him. So I don't know what the state of his career is now, but he certainly has been active on Twitter.
Yeah. But that may be his career right now. It's like you have an afterlife on Twitter. Well, Rosie Gray, thank you so much. And again, I strongly recommend that anybody that's interested in American politics or what has been happening on the right, read this piece, which is at BuzzFeed with the headline, "Get Out While You Can," a former alt-right member's message. It is it's a haunting, haunting piece and ought to raise lots of questions. So thanks for spending time with us today, Rosie.
Thanks so much for having me.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.